Move on to case 062170, Richard Reynolds versus Dawn Jamison and Christopher Darr. Ms. Wyman.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ruth Wyman. I represent Richard Reynolds, the plaintiff appellant in this case. This case comes to the appellate court from a grant of summary judgment by the district court on Section 1983 case and corollary state constitutional and common law claims based on a false arrest on July 12, 2004 and a subsequent false arrest on November 28, 2004. The court originally made a...
Did he plead guilty to the first one?
No, Your Honor. That's actually one of the main legal issue that I'd like to address.
You mean he didn't plead guilty?
Your Honor, the information that he pled guilty to, and that's in the docket report of number 23 in the docket, page 1, is that on or about May 2004 through July 2004, Richard Reynolds committed the offense of harassment by telephone, Class B misdemeanor, in that said defendant made a telephone call. Now, that's a telephone call. It's not for making a harassing telephone call on July 12 or several on July 12. It's he pled guilty to that. There was that was on December 6, 2004, but it was not on the...
It was the case pending on which he had been arrested.
I'm sorry?
Was the case pending on which he had been arrested?
If I understand your question right, the...
I didn't ask a question. It was a statement.
Oh.
Is that not the question? I'll put it in the form of a question. Is that not why he was arrested? What he pled guilty to?
He was arrested by Darr on July 12th for making harassing telephone calls.
And that's what he pled guilty to.
He pled guilty to the charge of making a call between May and July of 2004.
We're back to the equipment. He was arrested. He entered a plea of guilty.
But not for the charge that he was arrested for. That's our argument, Your Honor.
That doesn't make any sense. Well, was he not arrested for the one he pled guilty to?
He was arrested for making harassing telephone calls.
Wait, hold on. Was he arrested for the crime to which he pled guilty?
I think the answer is he pled guilty to making a...
No. Do it my way. He was arrested. He pled guilty. Did he plead guilty for the crime for which he was arrested?
I believe the answer is no, because...
What do you mean no? What did he plead guilty to? If he had never been arrested, how did he get there to plead?
He pled guilty to make...
To something that was totally off the wall someplace.
Your Honor, it wasn't off the wall. He pled guilty to making a harassing telephone call between May and July of 2004. What he was arrested for, was making harassing telephone calls to...
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. We believe that under the case law under Heck v. Humphrey, footnote 7 at page 487, also discussions in Wallace v. City of Chicago at 425 and 426, and Booker v. Ward at 1056, discuss how there, such a situation can be allowed for a false arrest claim, as Mr. Reynolds has regarding the July 12th arrest, and still have pled guilty to making a harassing telephone call between May and July of 2004. We believe that's allowed
for... Your argument, of course, is that there should have been discovery on that claim.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's because, as I believe it's Heck v. Humphrey, Heck v. Humphrey, Wallace, and Booker, I think, all discuss the issue of whether one can make a probable cause... whether the officer has probable cause to arrest is what information is before the officer at the time.
Of course, we've got a circuit split on all of that, and it's coming up before the Supreme Court.
The other issue, though, of course, is the distinction with the conviction is several months after the arrest, whether there's enough evidence to validate a conviction or Well, so whether so the amount of evidence that's necessary before a probable cause determination for an arrest is different than that which is in front of the
look. I take it what you're arguing is that he might have been convicted for a phone call that was different from the one underlying his arrest.
That's true. Yes, Your Honor, that's true. The other issue with the other legal issue with that is, as Heck v. Humphrey and Wallace and Booker all point out, that they recognize, and it's particularly in Booker, Booker v. Ward at 1056, that you can even though that's an accrual case on a Section 1983, but it recognizes that you can have a wrongful arrest claim with a valid conviction because the conviction is not inevitably undermined by the wrongful
arrest. Well, help me with this. Why isn't the broad language of the information enough to include any phone call that might have formed the basis for Officer Dar's decision to arrest him?
If I can answer that with the issue of the disputed material facts, if you look at the police report, Officer Dar's police report, which was in DACA entry 23, page 2, it says that he was dispatched at 1520, 3:20 in the afternoon, to Miss Jameson's home. She had called and asked for him to be there. He arrived at 1530, 10 minutes later. He arrested Richard Reynolds. It's on the bottom right of that page at 1534. 4 minutes later, he read him his Miranda rights. 2 minutes after that at 1536. As such, that information enough, I think, shows that there wasn't sufficient time for Dar to do what his brief and Ms. Jameson's motions for summary judgment and brief talk about him doing, which is going to our office, listening to 30 minutes of voicemails, talking to coworkers, information that wasn't even in the police report, and if you look at the times, wouldn't even be possible. The police report by defendant Dar, issued on July 12th, is significantly different than that affidavit for summary in support of his motion for summary judgment, 13 months after the July 12th arrest, and Ms. Jameson's affidavit is significantly different than the police report, than Dar's report, or than Dar's affidavit, and I think that information is clear that there's. There are significant factual disputes, similar to what this case, what this court decided in Pogoroishi versus Flying J about 6 months ago. The briefs and actually the motions submitted present multiple versions of facts about what Dar knew at the time of his arrest of both Reynolds and Jameson. I see that the white light is on. I'd like to reserve that. Thank you.
Mr. Foudras.
May it please the court, counsel. In answer to your question, Judge, yes. He did plead guilty to that for which he was arrested. He was arrested for making dozens and dozens and dozens of harassing telephone calls over a period of several months, and that's what he pled guilty to making harassing telephone calls. But I believe that this case can actually be settled much more easily, much more readily. The Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 56F was not followed. The rule is explicit. In this case, procedurally, what happened is, rather than file a motion to dismiss or an answer, I filed a motion for summary judgment. I also filed a motion to stay discovery, which was partially granted, partially denied. In response, the plaintiff filed a 56F motion with a memorandum and probably 10, 15 exhibits, one of which was an affidavit by the plaintiff himself. The affidavit itself did not comply with Rule 56F. There was a 28-paragraph affidavit. Only the last paragraph dealt with 56F. The rest was his recitation of what he believed occurred. And that final paragraph did not comply with the rule in that it did not state why discovery was needed and what he hoped to discover with additional discovery. So on that alone, on that basis alone, there was no need for additional discovery, and the court could have ruled and properly did rule based on the evidence before it. Aside from that, there's two separate arrests. I think addressing the July 12th arrest first.
How do we factor the Wallace case into all of this?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it can be, this case can be, well, first, I think that when Judge Baker issued his ruling back in January, it was completely consistent with the Seventh Circuit's interpretation of Heck. And I do acknowledge, as I think I have to, that Wallace now makes that interpretation inappropriate. And if this court were to rule that summary judgment was appropriate with respect to the July arrest based only on Heck and Wallace, then what I would ask is that it be held in, the decision be held in abeyance until the Supreme Court rules. But I don't think that's necessary. There's a number of reasons why the July 12th arrest should have been subject to summary judgment. First off, under the principles of collateral estoppel, I mean, there was a plea of guilty here. I think what we're dealing here, all the elements of collateral estoppel were met.
The plea of guilty to a telephone call or dozens of telephone calls?
Well, sure, it was a phone call, but he had made...
What do you mean, well, sure?
Well, he had made a phone call on July 12th. He was arrested for making...
But did he plead guilty to making a telephone call on July 12th? Or did he plead guilty to these dozens of calls?
Well, he pled guilty to making a harassing telephone call between May and July of 2004. And he was arrested, in fact, for making harassing telephone calls between that time period. That's what the evidence was.
Well, he could be arrested for just one phone call.
Certainly. I think it's clear that under, if my law is correct, it's Devin Peck versus Alford, the Supreme Court case from 2004, where you can be arrested for, there's probable cause, you can be arrested, as long as there's probable cause for any
one
crime.
Phone call.
That's correct.
For one phone call.
Yes, Your Honor, that's what I was trying to say. Thank you. But getting back to my point was that I think the July arrest can be just disposed of simply through collateral estoppel principles. And even, I think really the only issue, I think all the elements of collateral estoppel, I don't mean to be flippant, but there's really all the elements of collateral estoppel are met. I think the only one legitimately that could be at issue is whether, if the issue was previously litigated. In other words, it comes down to, was his arrest for a harassing phone call, whether there was probable cause, whether that was previously litigated. And I think there was. I mean, the arrest was based on an entire course of conduct. At issue was whether the plaintiff had harassed Jameson over a period of time, and that's, in fact, what he had pled guilty to. So I don't know that there's necessarily an issue whether collateral estoppel precludes a false arrest claim for the July arrest. And even aside from that, I think there's clearly probable cause, or at minimum, arguable probable cause for qualified immunity to attach. Counsel made reference to...
You got another buddy that's going to argue?
Yes, Your Honor. That's Ms. Jameson, and she has 5 minutes. I suppose if there's no further questions, I'll allow Ms. Jameson to plead her case. Thank you.
Ms. Jameson.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm the pro se party, Dawn Jameson. I wrote down a couple things to stay focused and not waste your time. I do have minimal legal knowledge. My understanding is this is based on two arrests, the one in July of 2004, which I believe was the lawsuit and conviction by the state's attorney addressed that. It appears that Mr. Reynolds is now trying to reopen that situation. I believe this court has the voicemails and exhibits from the state's attorney's case and Judge Baker's case, so in respect to time, I will just address an incident that occurred on October 25th, 2004, in relevance to the arrest 1 month later on November 28th, 2004. Mr. Reynolds clearly violated his order of protection. He drove back and forth in front of my home 7 times. And when it ultimately wound up was he was directly in front of my house and he aimed his truck at my son's bedroom window. Now, this is a person that a month prior in October sent an email death threat or kidnap threat to me at work, stealing someone's identity. When someone aims a truck at your child's bedroom, you have to take serious when they're revving their engine, and this truck is a 5,000-plus-pound Dodge Ram truck. They're going to drive through the bedroom. So I called the police. We were in danger, terrified, doesn't even begin to explain to you what has occurred over the last couple years. We were in danger. I called the police. It's as simple as that. When I hung up the phone, my involvement ended.
This incident ended. Took place in October, you say?
Yeah, it was addressed in the state's attorney's case. It was the email that they refer to in their case in regards to say goodbye to my son. And then a month later is when the November arrest occurred. I don't know what happened after I hung up the phone. I was never made of the final outcome. I found out when this lawsuit was filed, the police reports, and what had actually occurred. I believe that Judge Baker realized that limiting discovery was appropriate because I really don't have a lot to add. I'm not a police officer. I don't arrest people. It's not my profession. I honestly think I've probably shared everything that I can. Unfortunately, Mr. Reynolds is a very good predator. He's unpredictable. He's dangerous. There isn't any way for me to know what he's going to do at any given time. This continues to this day, and we're going on almost 3 years that I moved out of the home I shared with him. He continues to terrorize my family. He's using the legal system as another form of harassment. I moved on with my life 2.5 years ago. I simply want to continue on that venture and just have him go his direction. I feel I should be free to live my life and not be in danger, and I'm pleading with the court today to please encourage Mr. Reynolds to dismiss this case and tell him that he needs to move in another direction so my family and I can be safe again.
Thank you. Do you want to cede the rest of your time to Mr.
Yes, I would like to.
Have something else to say?
May I add one thing? Just because the incident keeps coming up, and I believe I addressed it in my affidavit, I don't know Mr. Darr. I have never had any type of a personal relationship with him, and I wanted you to hear that from me directly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, for giving me the opportunity. I think we focused exclusively on the July arrest. I also want to mention the November arrest really quickly. I think Ms. Jamison...
That one seems a lot more straightforward.
That was what Ms. Jamison was referring to.
Right.
So I think there's no question there was probable cause for that arrest, and I think Judge Baker was clearly correct in that. And unless there are any further questions, I just ask that Judge Baker's ruling be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. I'd like to address the November 28th issues. Ms. Jamison makes statements that I believe are outside of the record regarding phone calls, regarding some October phone calls. But regarding the November 28th arrest, what's clear from the police report on November 28th from the MetCAD call that was submitted as an attachment to docket entry 45 was that there was a priority 3 call, and there was no reference in that call to Reynolds driving back and forth or aiming the car or anything like that. In fact, the first mention of any sort of action like that was about 8 months when Ms. Jamison submitted her affidavit in support of her motion for summary judgment. It was not even referenced in Mr. Darr's affidavit in support of his motion for summary judgment. Interestingly as well is the fact that Don Jamison had, as what was part of Exhibit 23, her emergency order of protection filed July 13. On page 8 of 11, it clearly states, when respondent visits his relatives on East Pennsylvania, which is Ms. Jamison's address, same street Ms. Jamison moved to, respondent must use Philo Road entrance and exit only. Ms. Jamison had access to that emergency order of protection. Darr states in his affidavit that he contacted jail records and other people but found no such document. We've been precluded from doing discovery except limited to two short issues on the November 28th arrest because of the conflicting affidavits. We believe that there is that summary judgment was not appropriate, and Darr relies simply on in his brief on statements that were made by Jamison to him. We've been precluded from doing any discovery on Jamison to find out what in fact she did tell Darr when she told him, what information he had before he did the arrest as opposed to the conviction when the conviction occurred and after November 28th arrest.
Are we talking about the 500-foot rule? Or?
Yes, Your Honor. On the emergency order of protection, which was Exhibit 3 to Number 23, I want to make sure because there are two emergency orders of protection that were submitted in this case. One was submitted, and it says on the front, amended January 31. That was obviously not available or in any records on November 28, 2004. So it's the Exhibit 3 to Number 23, page 8 of 11, that clearly shows there was an exception for Mr. Reynolds to visit his family and be there for the family gathering on November 28th.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So thanks to Ms. Wyman, thanks to Mr. Futris, and thanks to Ms. Jameson. And the case will be taken under advisement.